in Canada, the people in Newfoundland know where the bay is, and the real bay, anyway. And everybody could welcome John, please.
Group, my name's John. I'm an addict.
Hi, John.
And every time I chair a meeting, I like to qualify myself in a very succinct way. And that is, I call myself an addict because I qualify myself as a person who suffers from a disease called addiction that's defined in the basic text. Other than that, I'm just like anyone else. See, when I came around, I thought the most important people at Narcotics Anonymous was the chairperson and the secretary, or the speaker and the chairperson, whatever you call it up here. Obviously, they knew what was going on, or else they wouldn't be sitting up here leading the meeting. And experience has shown it's not necessarily the case. You know, they aren't the most important people. So I don't want to give anyone the impression like I got it going on. No, I don't. I'm a human being, and I have this disease called addiction. It affects me mentally, physically, and spiritually. I thought I was different. Story of my life. I was asked to chair this meeting. I signed up for the pool list, and I found out this morning I had to chair it. So I'm thinking in the shower, brushing my teeth, and I thought I was different. My earliest thoughts was when I was about 6 years old. My brother died of sudden infant death syndrome, and we shared a room together. He was the only younger brother I had. And when we got the news, everybody in my family, it was a pretty big family, they were crying. And I wasn't, because I knew in my heart everything was okay. And then I was plagued with this paranoia that I was probably going to be suspect for his death because I was the only one who felt different than the rest of my siblings and my parents. And since then, I tried killing myself twice, once at 6 and once at age 8. I was not like everyone else. I felt alienated. I knew I was different. It's just the way it is. And I've come to realize since I've been trying to work a program recovery, That's like the number one feeling for most of us addicts. We are different. We were never a part of. The only part that I had involvement was trouble, you know. Finding ways and means to get more drugs and get into trouble. But all through growing up, I felt different. I was born in Illinois. I was raised in the suburbs of Los Angeles. And when I was 14, I moved to Maryland, or Maryland. I used to call it Maryland until I lived there. And I was looking forward to the geographical cure, you know? Like, oh, yeah, cool. And like, after a couple of weeks, man, Maryland sucks. I want to go back home. And I never felt right there. I felt like I went back in time. You know, I was different from everyone. They wore those funny boat shoes, and they had, like, those Izod shirts and the Oxford shirts, and they talked funny, and like, they all had accents, that southern drawl. And in fact, it took me a couple of years to say y'all. You know, I wasn't used to the way the dialect. I only lasted there about a year and a half. My parents kicked me out of my house. I was different. They didn't know how to control me. I think it doesn't really matter what type of background I had. You know, I could spend hours and psychoanalyze my upbringing. But it doesn't negate the fact that I've had a certain feeling like the rest of you had of being different. You know, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? I wasn't brought up in a way to share my feelings. Huddling around a fire or around the corner, using with other addicts. You know, one is not inclined to say, ooh, I feel different today. I feel alienated. May I share with you? It's just not happening, you know. Even if I was conscious of it, I wasn't willing to do that. You know, I really wasn't aware of what feelings were and what was going on with John. You know, paranoia was a way of life. And it kept me further isolated from other people. I used to live, and I lived to use until I was about 20, and I went to a rehab. It was like a catch-22 situation. Either I violate a 2-year sentence for felony theft and breaking and entering by getting nabbed by the cops, or by the grace of God. My dad was there and talked to him. He said, look, I'll get him into a rehab. So I went to a rehab, and I'll tell you this, you do not need a rehab to find this new way of life. You do not need to go through an institution to get clean. You can get clean on your own. And when I went to rehab, I had the substantial history of using drugs and all the lifestyle behaviors that are associated with it. And I left this rehab an alcoholic. Okay, this was 1984. In my area, the area was even formed then. It was officially formed in 1985. There's like a handful of meetings around the area where I lived. And in the rehab industry, Narcotics Anonymous is bullshit. It doesn't work. And when I was at the rehab, I was looking for the differences. You know, I'm sure they told me about how I can network in NA and how I could hang with the guys and get their numbers and hang out with them. But I did hear a few different type of suggestions, you know. And I was told that Narcotics Anonymous is full of shit because all the guys who go to the meetings, they wear leather jackets and they look like bikers, but you don't see a Harley out in the parking lot, you know. So I looked for that, and it was true. But all the guys, they go to hug the chicks and they grab their buns. And well, I think I did see one guy, you know, like embrace this woman and pick her up and lean her towards him. And I'm like, man, this is a bunch of shit. And I found out that people excessively cuss at the meetings and use profanity. So I looked for that. And lo and behold, it was true. And I surmised, yeah, this is a bunch of crap, you know. There's no recovery here. And I didn't really go to Narcotics Anonymous throughout 1985. I kind of went between fellowships, this one and another 12-step fellowship. And I make these little cameo appearances in NA and kind of tell you people how full of shit you were because you weren't talking about living the steps on a day-to-day basis and all you were doing was glamorizing your drug use. And I didn't stay clean for more than 4 months. I picked up on differences in rehab and I operated on them. And I couldn't recover even in the other 12-step fellowship that I went to. I had an attitude of indifference and intolerance to some of the spiritual principles. You know, I was kind of taking things cafeteria style. You know, I'd take on some of the suggestions because I thought maybe they apply to me. Like, yeah, I'll get a sponsor, but I want to get honest with them. I went to meetings and I shared. I wasn't sharing from the heart what was going on. I was trying to sound good. And I was about change. You know, I got my hair cut and I started wearing ties and jackets, you know. But I wasn't trying to take a look at inside John and share what was going on. I was really full of crap. And I couldn't see that within myself. And I bounced around for about a year. And in November of 85, I said, screw this, you know. You know, I can't say that I relapsed, maybe because I never really got involved in a program of recovery, because I was doing things my way. And I went back out again, and it was just, you know, just a reefer and just beer, and I'll be okay if I use those soft drugs. And about 2 years goes by, and the quality of my lifestyle went downhill, living on a day-to-day basis. I had money for drugs whenever I could hustle together, or else... or whatnot, but I didn't really have money for food or insurance for the car, and I was just getting by. But in the summer of 87, it was great, man, because I was living in this house with a bunch of other using addicts. You know, my rent was like $70 a month, and there were four other people who liked to use hard, and I was bringing in $350 a week. And I told myself, oh, I can't get any better than this. And I was entirely too correct. It went downhill really fast from there. Let's see, I wrecked my roommate's car, so I signed my car over to him. Got in an argument with a person and got the shit kicked out of me. Put me out of work for 3 weeks. By the time I got back to work, I was laid off, and I had another overdose. And I finally came to the conclusion what these people were saying in the meetings were true. You know, I can't use anymore. This will kill me. I cannot safely control my usage of drugs. And I need to go to meetings. No, I need to get involved. I need to do what these people are talking about in the meetings. I need to live those steps in my life. And I've got to be willing to do anything. Because I finally, once again, had a desire not to use. And I think that's the gift from my higher power. And what I do with it is totally up to me. And it might be a gift to someone else. And I finally caught on because I got off the couch. I went to the bathroom. My roommate said, hey, man, you want to do something? I was like, no. And I'm taking a leak, and I'm like, wow, I just said no. I could capitalize on this. I got a desire not to use. I better be doing something to maintain this desire, or I'm going to lose it fast. So next day I went to my folks' house, you know, go to their house. Like, hey, guess what? You know, I decide I don't want to use anymore. I'm going to be clean and sober. And they're like, that's nice, but you have to excuse us. We have a garage sale to attend to. You have to leave right now. I'm like, damn. Man, I'm all sincere, you know, and you know, at least they just give me a couple bucks. And it dawned on me, well, how many times did I tell them that? How many times, oh, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. I'm sorry, Dad. I'm sorry. And I was really sorry, motherfucker, and I didn't know it. Because I didn't think I was all that bad, because I wasn't like you people in these rooms. You know, I was like a high bottom addict. But experience has shown that the longer I stay clean, the more aware I've become of how sick I was and how sick I am. I went to my first day clean. I went to another meeting, another 12-step fellowship, and I didn't get a whole lot out of it. It's funny, some of the people who I used to associate with like 3 years prior, they had better things to do than pick me up to take me to my first meeting. And I went to a meeting on my own, didn't get what I needed, and then there was a midnight meeting, and I went there and it was closed. And I was like pretty angry. I called the hotline and I talked to the student. I'm like, hey, where's the meeting? You know, I'm right in front of the building. And the guy laughed on the phone. He said, oh, it's obviously there. It's in the schedule. Ha, 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 ha. And I was going through some feelings, man, because I'm not using anymore. And I don't know. I'm really frustrated and I'm scared. And I can't even recognize these things. And I cursed them out and I slammed the phone down. And then in desperation, I sought help through Narcotics Anonymous. I knew there was a midnight meeting down the street. I went there and it wasn't there. I called the hotline, like, what's up? And they called me back, so they moved it down Duke of Gloucester's, down St. Mary's. So I went down there, and I went in there, and I was, I was willing to do anything to get clean was my attitude. You know, I hear some people in my area say, you got to be really willing to get this. You got to be willing to stand in the corner on your head and eat dog shit to stay clean. And if you get that type of willingness, you might make it. And I like saying that because the way I felt about hugging some of you people and getting your phone numbers and getting key tags without having keys to put them on, you know, house keys or car keys. And I was like, I'd rather eat dog shit, you know. It was written in the literature. Yeah, we all humbly ate dog crap. You know, I would have done it. Because as the cliche goes, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I think I finally had enough and I came to the realization this is a deadly disease. You know, being as different as I was, I had my fair share of psychiatrists, psychologists, stuff like that, expulsions, suspensions, arrests, and came close to death twice in my using. And it's becoming apparent this thing is progressive. You know, I used to minimize this disease concept. I'm like, I'm in rehab, like the disease. You know, you look in a microscope and you can find a disease. You know, what the hell is this thing, this addiction? How can that be a disease? And then I found out that the three criteria for any disease, that it's life-threatening, is fatal. It is progressive in nature, and there's no cure for it. If you're fortunate, you get some type of treatment. I started opening my mind up to what the people said in the meetings, and I looked back at my track record, and what you people were sharing about was relative to me. That first night I got to the meeting, I was about a half hour late, and I walked in, and the secretary had this glow about him. This is a midnight meeting. I ended up being my home group for like 3 or 4 years. This guy had a glow about him, like everything would be all right. I can't really express that feeling in words, but I got a sense of peace of mind from him. And then there's this guy who he stood up in the meeting, it was his turn to share, right? And he just let loose. He was angry. He had some resentments. People apparently in the fellowship were gossiping about him, and he came right out with it, and he said exactly what was going on with him. I couldn't say this shit in confidence to anyone what he said. He got to the exact nature of the rumors, and some of it was true. And my jaw hit the ground, like, wow. And this guy's honestly sharing what's going on. And it impressed the heck out of me. He didn't care what people thought about him. He had to share what was going on with him. And he was being honest. But then I looked to the right of the room, and there were these three guys. And I found out after the meeting, they all had like 3 years. They stayed clean. And it dawned on me that if it could work for these people and this guy can honestly share, uninhibited, and this guy who's like leading the meeting has this warm glow about him, maybe I need to keep coming back. And I did. I went to a meeting the next night, and I got my one-day key tag. And there's this interesting character in my area named Steve M. And I've gone toe-to-toe with him quite a bit. Actually, I did back in 85, because I used to work at this college, and they'd bring an NA meeting there, and he'd be saying to me, hey, why don't you come in and check out our meeting? And he knew me very well. I went to the other fellowship. And I'm like, yeah, right, I don't need you people. And I'd kind of like, you know, prod him a little bit. And he'd prod back to me, very sarcastic. And when I picked up my one-day key tag, he gave me a hug. And he said, welcome back. And the guy did not lay into me until I had about 3 or 4 months, until I was a little stable, where he could, like, dose me with his sarcasm. And that meant a lot to me. I started making a more conscious effort to compare myself in, because I heard people share, compare yourself in. Don't compare your insides from people's outsides, that we're more common than we are different. And I found out in my first 3 to 6 months clean. The reason why all those guys who had like the leather jackets and the Harley paraphernalia, you know why they didn't have a bike out in the parking lot? It was the middle of winter. You know, most bikers I know do not ride bikes in wintertime. You know, it's an attitude of indifference, right? Attitude for me, that's how I look at things, and I have a choice today. That's where the freedom comes in. Not only do I not have to use, but I don't have to act in the same ways, and I don't have to view things in counterproductive ways. You know, I could look at the glass being half filled as opposed to being half empty. In the situation with these bikers, right, I modified my attitude. Maybe I had enough pain that I was willing to look at things different. And I started comparing myself then, and it was tough. I was scared. The addicts in my area at the time, most of them shot heroin, or they did coke, or they smoked angel dust. And that was basically it. There's no other type of addicts. And I guess I really had to categorize my drug of choice, like it really makes a rat's ass difference. It was acid. And it was hard for me to compare myself in, because I didn't think I was all that bad. I wasn't laying in the gutter with a needle in my arm. And I found some guys 8 days after I came in, this guy, his drug of choice was hallucinogens too. We stuck together with each other, and we went to a lot of meetings with each other. And I found out that I'm at least like one other person. We're about the same age. He grew up in that area, and we had some mutual interests. And I found out the more people that I reached out to, the more people I found were like me. Like maybe out of 50 or 100 addicts, I found one or two good friends. You know, they told me to get phone numbers and use them. I was homeless for my first 2 months getting clean this time. Because after a week of living with these using addicts, and when I wasn't using, I was about to revert back to the animal level of living. And I knew I had to get out of there. It was hard for me to make some changes by getting phone numbers and hanging out at the meeting after the meeting. See, I don't think that should apply to me in the past about going to bowling alleys and movie theaters and oh God, dances. My heart really goes out to newcomers who get like, you know, yoked along. Come on, we're going to go to an NA dance. We're going to have fun. And you're probably lonely right now and frustrated. And you're going to see other people have a good time. Isn't that fun? I really couldn't get down with that. But I was willing to eat that dog shit to get clean. And I did a lot of things I didn't like doing. But I felt better as a result. Because one of the first meetings I came back to, this chick celebrated 3 years clean. And in closing, she said, you know, recovery is the toughest thing I've ever done for myself, but it's the best thing I've ever done for myself. And I think it was time for John to start learning how to live life without the use of drugs. And I don't know what else to do except what works for you people. Being different. They called me a freestyler in my area. I lived in a house called Serenity Row because of the three of us. I found that the guy who spoke out at the meeting, at my first meeting, who like, you know, yelled at everybody and got really gut level honest, and the guy whose drug of choice was hallucinogens, but we ended up moving in together. Something I didn't feel like doing. I didn't believe in it. But after talking to my sponsor and I came to the realization I need to take risks for my recovery. I took risks out there for self-destruction. Why should it be different? So I got to, you know, turn and walk in a different direction and go through the same type of pain, the obstacles, the confusion, and the risks, but the benefits I was told would be worth the while. And as soon as I hung up with him in that conversation, I got a phone call. It's like, hey, we got an extra room. You want to come in? And I'm thinking, man, I live by myself now. It's within walking distance to work. Why would I want to move all the way up to Annapolis? Because it was something different. You know, a positive different thing. I got to take some action. And I ended up moving in with these people. And we were a weird bunch because my first or second sponsor, he went to different fellowships. You know, hey man, I was willing to do anything. So we went to 3 12-step fellowships. In the meantime, I'm reading the basic text on a daily basis because like when you're hungry and you're homeless and you're jobless and you got the privilege of having somebody front you with basic text, it gets your mind off the hunger, it gets your mind off your fears and where you're going to spend the night. And really quick, I got an education about NA language, and that is invaluable to me. So, like, I'm basing my recovery through the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous, right? Reading the literature and going to, like, 2 other 12-step fellowships. In my area back then, I distinctly recall that if you were sharing what was going on with you or if you personalized your concept of a higher power, people will cut you off abruptly in the meeting. They say, that's against traditions. Outside issue. And that shit did not attract me to come back. I found out in these other, or one particular other 12-step fellowship, It was like a free-for-all. You could say anything you want. You know, people were talking Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, agnosticism. I was like the only person there talking the basic text at the meetings, right? And this went on for about a year, year and a half. And I was going to about 7 to 10 meetings, and about a good 5 or 7 of them were NA meetings. And it dawned on me when I went to this meeting and I needed an anchor, you know, I needed to hear the NA language. And see, that's different for me now. See, I could talk like a recovering addict, and I could say, yeah, I believe in NA language, I believe in Narcotics Anonymous, when, like, I don't know, 7 years ago, I'd look at a person talking like me today and say, get a grip, man! Get a life! This shit's a cult! This shit is saving my life today. And I found out through experience that when I need to, that anchor, when I need to listen to someone at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, I better go to an NA meeting. Because these people are talking all this happy-go-lucky, warm, fuzzy cream shit, which worked for them, but it wasn't working for me. You know, it's like I developed a dependency on NA terminology. As much as I hate those cliches when I came around, I mean, they really bothered me. I gave them that much power. Now, in a short period of time, I depended on them. They were my anchor. It gave me hope. You know, things were going to be okay if I keep coming back, live just for today. It doesn't have to be that way. Pain can be a motivating factor. And I altogether stopped going to other fellowships. I evolved into that creature, which I had no respect for, but, you know, an NA purist, you know, because I couldn't dig it. I didn't have that much exposure with NA. And now, I mean, oh, they called me a freestyler back then. And I used to, you know, scoff at like purist addicts. In other words, addicts who went only to NA. Like, they weren't with it. They were getting brainwashed. They don't have a life. You know, they got NA for their dependency. And I was really close to the idea. And experience has shown this is where I belong. You know, recovery is a process. It's ongoing. And I think the more I try to live these, you know, try to live honesty in my life and being open-minded, I can see a lot more of where other people are coming from. And that's very beneficial. You know, I need to compare myself in, because I could compare myself out in a heartbeat. I used to have a problem talking about other people's understanding of God or higher power. I sometimes still have a hard time listening to other people talk about NA service, you know, the way they see it. Probably because I don't have unity within myself, because I don't want to open my mind to hear where other people are coming from. You know, it's so easy for me to bullshit myself and say, oh yeah, you know, that attitude of indifference or intolerance, that was really crucial when you're building that foundation of recovery. But now you've gone through all the 12 steps and that all your service positions, you know, you're untouchable. You don't have to listen to what other people have to say. And I really tell myself that, and it's hard for me to see that. Because I've been involved here, I've been involved there, I've got this time. You know, it took me 4 years to get 1 year clean, I got all this insight. And like I hit the ceiling, you know, I limit myself. And that's why it's really important for me to continue to do things that worked in the beginning to keep my mind fresh and keep it open. Getting back to like the God concept or higher power, it's disheartening for me when I hear people make a big commotion. Either they're pro the G word or against the G word and stuff like that. You know, there are people like us who are dying because we're in the rooms being too overly concerned about the politics of NA and the service of NA, and NA won't be there without me. Shit, give me a break. NA will go long on before, you know, and after my existence. And when we get hung up on a concept of a higher power or a power greater than ourselves or God as we understood him, where's our effort toward the newcomer? Because I'm guilty of this, man. I have self-righteously proclaimed axioms and the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, when I could have best utilized that effort toward trying to listen to a newcomer or maybe cater to him or her after the meeting. Attitude of indifference to the way other people are saying things. I couldn't before talk about God or whatnot or philosophies or other people's things. But you know, in Narcotics Anonymous, it took an agnostic who is somebody who I sponsored. It took him to really shine the light on my understanding of the third step when I went over it with him. You know, I had some Taoists really teach me the principle of letting go and living. I couldn't talk to people of certain persuasions, let's say, you know, different philosophical beliefs, different religious backgrounds. I couldn't, or I chose not to. And it was really scary for me to hear other people's ideas. especially about that. And but you know, I told myself I was willing to eat that dog shit to stay clean. And I listened to people, and I found out they had something to offer. And these were the missing pieces which I couldn't get throughout my life. And that if I extracted the principle from the person who was speaking, that I find out the gift of recovery is within everything that's living. Sometimes it's easier for me to get it. You know, I'm at a meeting, somebody's speaking the way I like to hear. I'm like, wow, they just gave me the message on a silver platter. You know, my spirituality's increased now. But most times I have to work for my recovery. And I have to work hard to extract something positive out of what they're saying. Or maybe open my narrow mind up a little bit to take in what they're saying. And try and find the underlying principal forces. It usually has something to do with honesty or open-mindedness or willingness. I like sometimes a quote from the basic text in my meetings, you know. I used to despise people who did that. Like, you know, they can't think for themselves, you know. They're robots in this cult, and they got to quote the basic text, you know. I saw one guy from Williamsport, Pennsylvania. He'd read out of the basic text. I'm like, jeez. And a few years later, when I had about his time, I started doing the same things he did. And not really giving two fucks what other people thought. I mean, I don't read out of basic text, you know, in a meeting, but I'll quote it. And see, I'm kind of saying that right now because one thing that's very meaningful to me is about our concept of a higher power. It does not come from dogma. It's not a firmly held belief. It's something that is open. And I think we say in our literature the prerequisites or the requirements for higher power is that it be loving, caring, greater than ourselves. Guess what, folks? I don't know anything about loving or caring. What I did was a smidge. I relied on you people to show me by example what was love and what was care. And the first example that comes to my mind was seeing one person pick up an ashtray for someone else. Somebody spilled coffee, and another person cleaned it up. And that was an act of love for me. That was an act of care. I really got to get hip to what you people are talking about so I can be honest for that first time since that first tie about coming to believe in something, a power greater than myself. Because I turned my will, my life over to a destructive force, which is greater than myself, you know, the disease of addiction. And I really can't tell you what my concept of a higher power, God, we understood him, power greater than ourselves, whatever you feel comfortable referring to it as, because it's very personal, and it doesn't have to make sense to other people, as long as I can be honest within my heart and have a belief that things are going to be okay, you know, a way which kind of brings the best out of me, where I can be a little more open-minded, a little bit more willing to help a newcomer, then that's the thing that's working for me, then that's the right idea. And it's really hard for me at times when I hear people, certain, like I said, philosophical, religious persuasions, but I know if I work at it, I get a gift out of it. I see where they're coming from, and I see how it could apply to me so I could be less serious about myself or maybe a little friendlier toward other people. I thought I was different. I still do at times. Man, with about 3.5 years of recovery, I went to see my dad. My dad was living in the Bahamas, and I was engaged at that time, and I went down there and I saw him. See, I'm a unique addict. Yeah. You ever open up the basic text, I was unique, that one chapter? Man, I was pissed off when I read it because it wasn't me. You know, I thought they were going to tell my story because I always thought I was unique and I read the story and I'm like, oh God, I compare myself out of that chapter. No. Or the pamphlet, Isolation and Recovery. Oh, cool. You know, maybe I can stay clean without having to interact with other addicts. And I read through the pamphlet. Oh man, it's not what I want to hear. Man, it doesn't apply to me. You know, that's one sense of being different. But now I got a couple years clean, right? And I had two nevers in recovery. One is I will not go into any form of psychotherapy, and I will not get involved with a religious organization. And to my surprise, this guy's got 14 years in my area, said, John, it's been my experience, most addicts who make it and continue to make it either go into psychotherapy or they get into some form of religion. And my immediate thought was, he said most. I always look to beat the odds. And somehow I did, you know. So I figure I'm comparing myself out, and I found out last year I went through 6 months of therapy. You don't need it to stay clean. You don't need it to be a member of a Narcotics Anonymous. The point I say in bringing that out is, as soon as some people say, most of us, I'm different. I'm quick to cop to that. I'm not going to be open-minded to like what works for most of us. And I found out it was okay for me to go through what I had to go through, 6 months of psychotherapy. And I'm not ashamed to say that today. And it's really ironic because I've got like shitloads of psychology credits from my college experiences. Like, I should know better. Anyway, when I had about 3.5 years clean, I went down to the Bahamas and saw my dad. I was engaged at the time. And I'm laying out like my life plan to him. So, you know, I just graduated. I got my bachelor's degree. I'm going to get this master's degree. And then I'm going to slip through the back door and get that PhD. And I'm going to marry this chick. And let's see, I was going to get married within like a year and a half. I was going to get this degree, and I was going to go toward the PhD and work in the meantime at a really nice halfway house. And you know, my dad, you know, I don't know him all that well, and he's saying, well, what if this doesn't happen? Oh, what if that doesn't happen? Oh, no, this is foolproof. This is going to happen. And like within a year and a half, she left the relationship. The halfway house closed down due to budget cuts. And I became disillusioned with that master's program. And I was like, man, fuck this. And I left. And people kind of sensed I was different because I was going on to get what I wanted. I was told I could do anything I want in life as long as, one, I put recovery first, and two, I'm willing to put forth the effort to get it, and three, I'm willing to pay the consequences. And I was having a life in addition to going to meetings and hanging out with a fellowship. And it's not like I looked at myself different than other recovering addicts. I know people with businesses, nice cars, families. I think people get, I mean, we get what we want in life once we learn how to use these tools so we could go about this thing in a healthy way. And I think that's great. But I kind of sense people in the fellowship were viewing me different because, like, I was going on for higher education. And, you know, they got some cute little nicknames for me, like the doctor, the professor. And I really hate hearing that because I feel like people are going out of their way to put me aside. But I don't have to feel that way today. And I try not to talk about that stuff. You know, like, you know, in fact, I've been in school for a while. Because I don't want people to think I'm putting myself on a pedestal, or I don't want to put myself apart from other addicts. Because I've done what a lot of you have done, and I go through the same feelings that most of you go through. And just recently, about feeling different, I just lit my mind. I guess I'll try to close it by saying, when it first came around, I heard a lot of you say some really off-the-wall shit. You know, some of my first meetings, I heard this guy talking about, he just got out of a relationship. Oh my God, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then some other person shared, oh, I got all these bills to pay. And I'm thinking to myself, get a fucking life. Thank God you got bills to pay. It's a relationship? God, you don't feel like using right now, do you? You got a warm place to stay tonight, huh? Maybe if you hang in there, you could get sucked into another unhealthy relationship. What's the big fucking deal? Little did I know, because I hadn't been in their shoes, I hadn't progressed in recovery. They were living life on life's terms. And I really tried killing my cynical attitude, because I really couldn't relate to you people who'd been around for a while. But experience has shown, I started doing the same things you were doing, growing the fuck up, trying to live life on life's terms. I've had my ups and downs with relationships, I've had my ups and downs with bills, and now I'm a lot like most of you. Man, I owe a shitload of money. You know, I thought certain things were beneath me, and they weren't. Bouncing in and out of relationships, you know, going on a rebound relationship, borrowing money off the plastic card because I'm entitled to things today. I'm a lot like you in finding out. And the best thing that could help me out is trying not to get that fixed. I like hearing my sponsor share, and he shares quite often at meetings that I used to think when I got a place to live, I'd be okay. And I told myself that. Yeah, man, I'm homeless right now. Once I get a place, and I got a place. And then that wasn't good enough. You know, they advertised for a drug-free roommate, and they were doing coke and beer in there, and pot and everything else. And I had to get the fuck out, and I did. If I could only find another place, and I did. So one place, I rented from this woman. I was basically by myself, and rent was cheap. And I'm like, wow, cool. Man, if I could only get a car, you know. And I got a car. Then I moved in with these roommates. If only things could work out here, I'm really scared things did. We bonded. We were very much the same. I was going to tell you a story about something between the three of us, but I can't, because this tape ever goes back in the Bay Area, then they're going to find out these two guys. It's like fifth step material. But I found, oh yeah, doing a step four and five, I found I'm just like you people. It's when I did my fifth step, I chose some guy. He's a guy who has like 14 years. He's got one tooth and one eye. His name's Frank, and he's a crazy motherfucker, and people don't understand him. But the guy's clean today, and he's trying to change his life. And I picked him because I didn't think there was anybody sicker in the fellowship than this person, right? So why would he want to tell my stuff, right? You know, he's probably done tenfold. And by doing steps four and five with someone, when I left, it wasn't like I had this acute spiritual awakening, but I think it was the first time I truly felt like you people. When I left that table, I was like, I could go to any meeting and go through that door and know I'm just like everyone else, because I buried my soul. I kind of sort out my morals, and I found out ways of being right and ways of being wrong, and I found out at least I'm not the only other person who's done some really twisted, sick, bizarre things. And I do have some assets, and it's about time I start owning up to it. And I think that's the decisive factor in my recovery, of like feeling different. You know, I honestly, for years, when in my area, when you get done sharing, people say, keep coming back. I truly thought you meant deep down in your heart, stay the fuck away. I honestly believe that. You know, that's where I was viewing myself. But, God, I was trying to wrap this thing up. I have a choice today if I want to appear different or not. And most times, I feel like a member, meaning I don't feel unique. I don't have a great need to be unique. Sometimes I do when I think about what I want to wear before I go out the door. But it's not like a way of life. I don't have to work so hard at putting up an image or facade just so you people stay away from me or you will prove me in a really alternative sort of way. I'm finding out now it's not the fixes. It's not getting the guitar. It's not getting this. It's not the car. Even though those things are nice and they work temporarily. But I'm okay whenever I decide to put myself first by putting one foot in front of the other and having a belief that things will be okay today. That's the greatest joy I've had in recovery, because it works, thick or thin, high or low, better or worse. Just having the knowledge that things will be okay, you know, whatever I'm going through will pass. I mean, why do I need to be unique when I've got something I can hold on to, you know, a belief, something that's encouraging. You know, my uniqueness in trying to set myself apart from you people, it takes a lot of work. And like the paranoia and the loneliness creeps in more and more and more. And I'll shut up by saying I really hope to be able to do this stuff that I preach today more than I talk about it. You know, that's my goal in recovery, and that's why the sky's the limit, because I'll probably never get there. And I'm going to open it up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. I have this scripted thing here that I'm supposed to read to you, so I'm going to sort of go off that. I'd like to just say thank you very much. You know, when I was listening to you, the concept of the thinking we were different, that nearly killed me, and it nearly kills a lot of people. And until I started seeing that I wasn't really different, that's when I started getting better. I have a little difficulty with the eating shit thing. That, although, you know, when I was thinking about it, and I must have been doing it when I was out there, because when I came in here, I was quite full of it, and my sponsor was more than willing to point that out to me, and today I thank him for it. Back then, I was too sensitive for that sort of thing. So again, I'd like to say on behalf of CCNA, we would like to thank John M. of Maryland. Is that better? The Bay. For sharing his experience, strength, and hope with us. So if we could give him a hand.